For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Today on The Grave Talks, studying parapsychology, a conversation with Dylan Jones. Anyone who listens to this show is obviously interested in the paranormal. But very few people are interested in the paranormal to the point they are getting a PhD in the subject. Dylan Jones is currently undertaking his PhD in parapsychology at Robert Gordon University in Aberdeen, Scotland. It is one of the few universities that offer a degree in parapsychology. Dylan is studying media influences and professional practices of modern paranormal groups. How does the paranormal media portrayals influence investigators of ghosts and hauntings? Today on The Grave Talks, a conversation about the field of parapsychology with Dylan Jones. So Dylan, thanks for coming back on the show. And a few weeks back, we talked to you and your fiance Bridget about Haunted Savannah and the Witching Hour Paranormal. And if you haven't listened to that episode yet, please go back and listen to it. It was very interesting. So you and I were working together to set up that interview when I found out that you were working on your PhD in parapsychology. And I was like, wait, that's an episode in itself. So thank you very much for coming back to talk about you. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for inviting me back. And it's a privilege and an honor to be able to do it.
Any PhD is overwhelming, daunting. I've never gone through the process. I know people who have, and it's a lot of work. What made you decide, I think I want to study that and get a PhD in that? How did you make that leap?
It's been a long journey, actually. And my journey started when I was 7 years old. At that age, my uncle, who was a police officer, somebody who I looked up to, you know, both literally and figuratively at that age, he sadly passed away from cancer at the age of 36. So as you can imagine, the whole family were devastated at that point. And it was a couple of months later, I woke up in the middle of the night and I see him standing in my bedroom doorway and then fading away. And I look back today at that experience and think, well, that could have a psychological explanation, what we call a hypnopompic experience. When you're waking from a dreamlike state, the dream is still continuing even though you're partially awake. But I'm open-minded enough to accept that, you know, it could be the other. So when it comes to me examining cases of alleged ghosts and hauntings and so on, I approach it with a critical but open mind. And then it was a couple of years later then, in 1984, when I pestered my mum like anything to take me to the cinema to see a certain film about ghosts that came out that year. So if I were to say to you, who you're going to call?
Ghostbusters.
Exactly. So I saw that and I was like, my goodness, that's what I want to be. But of course, back then, we didn't have, luckily, any of the TV shows that we have today. So my primary source of information was speaking to people who'd actually had experiences. And my mum told me an experience that she had when she was 17. I spoke to other family members and then I started getting books from the local library and the library at the college my dad worked in, and the librarian there, I still remember Mrs. Holvey, she would get books for me so my dad could bring them home. So I was immersing myself in print media to learn from people, the likes of Peter Underwood, Lloyd Auerbach, Guy Playfair, Andrew McKenzie, all these people who had written books that were journalists or very skilled in a particular area. And I started investigating. I joined the academic societies from a young age. And then when I was 20, I followed in my uncle's footsteps. I became a police officer for almost 18 years, but had to retire in December 2012 because I got injured on duty. So I took that as an opportunity then to think, right, one part of my career is over with. I've always maintained my interest in the paranormal with some amateur research and working with some of the academic societies, but I thought, right, I can do my degree. So I thought, well, I'm going to do media production because I've always had this passion for media. And then when I was doing that, I started doing different things and producing features that related to paranormal research. So documentaries, radio documentaries, print media, and so on. And when I completed that, I thought, well, I'll take a couple of years to sort of earn some more money and look at what I'm going to do with the future. But then by 2019, I thought, no, the PhD is the route that I want to go down. So I decided then that my degree or my doctorate degree would be looking at a particular area. And that area was to look at how the media represents the paranormal and the people who research it, but then see whether or not it influences the behavior of modern ghost hunting groups. So, you know, are they watching the TV shows like Ghost Adventures, Ghost Nation, Most Haunted, and the many others that there are? Or are they watching the movies like The Conjuring about Ed and Lorraine Warren? Or are they reading books, listening to podcasts, engaging with any form of social media? And are any of those things, all of them, some of them, none of them, affecting the behavior? You know, the things that they say, the things that they do, the equipment that they use, why they think they're scientific. Why do a lot of them nowadays think they're being professional? Why do they think that they have to get qualifications to do what they do? Does that enhance their credibility? Which is the point I would like to touch on later, is about these so-called doctorates in parapsychology, which are not actually doctorates. But that's a subject I'll talk about in a bit if you can. So that's what led me to where I am. That's sort of the potted version of what got me to this point.
And parapsychology as a field of study, for someone who's not really looked into that, what's the definition that you would use for parapsychology?
Well, it's exploring human experience and the survival, the means of communication that are not ordinarily accepted by modern science. So it's usually split into three areas. You've got extrasensory perception, so obtaining information by not the normal means that we have. The area of psychokinesis, looking at whether or not we can influence the environment around us, objects, move things. And then there's also the survival-related area. So that would be looking at whether or not, you know, the consciousness survives bodily death, and those looking at hauntings, ghosts, poltergeists, that kind of thing. The first two areas are the ones that if there is a university that wants to study it, like there are some in the UK that do that, that's the area they're more likely to look at, because you can impose and put laboratory controls on what you're studying. So, for example, one of my colleagues and friends, Professor Cal Cooper at Northampton University, he's looking at things like the Ganzfeld experiment, where you go into a flotation tank, you take away stimuli, and they see whether or not information can be relayed by somebody who is actually elsewhere. And they're researching that at the moment. But when it comes to studying ghosts and hauntings, it's very difficult because, firstly, we never know when it's going to happen. And it's very difficult to put all the controls necessary on a particular place and on the people who are likely to have the experiences. So it's very difficult for a university then to say, well, yeah, we'll commit money to this and commit people to study it for what is likely to be very limited return. So my area of understanding is that I'm looking at the parapsychology from a cultural aspect, so anthropology, social science, and media effects, whereas I have other colleagues looking at the physical sciences and the psychology of things like electronic voice phenomena. So, you know, there is a broad range, but I feel that It's an area that is so open to studying of the human experience.
And really, that's what it's all about, the human experience in paranormal studies. I would think, you know, even from the extrasensory perception, people knowing things that how are they able to know that? That's all anecdotal too. There's no way you can get into someone's brain and go, this is how that works. Or, you know, if someone has a paranormal experience that they can't explain, because I do believe everything should try to be debunked first. I don't think that, you know, if I hear something falling off my counter, that's paranormal. That's a cat in my house. But you know what I'm saying? I think a lot of times people will jump to the paranormal when there might be other explanations. But when it really does happen, that's just my word. I can't prove that it happened. I can just tell you what I saw or what I experienced. And so I think that makes it difficult to study scientifically. Because like you did just mention, you can't go someplace and just turn it on. Is it going to happen? Maybe. Maybe not. You don't know.
Very much so. And I think part of the issue today is that over the last 20 to 25 years, we have had this great upsurge in media interest through reality TV and films, where people now want to go ghost hunting. And the idea that people want to get involved and interested is great. But what has happened is you now have a flood of people who are looking to have a spooky experience. They're not trying to understand what the witness has experienced. So when my colleagues and I look at things, I mean, because of my previous job as a police officer, I was trained in cognitive interviewing of witnesses and interviewing, obviously, suspects. And there are methods of controlling conversation or extracting information to get a full picture of what the witness has experienced. That is not done generally by investigators today. It's very much, oh, somebody's reported that they've got a ghost. Let's go in with all this equipment. And they forget that you have to have a witness to have the experience. Or they'll go into a building. Oh, that looks spooky. Let's go and investigate it. Let's get some EVP. It's like a police officer going into a bank and thinking, oh, right, has there been a robbery in here? Let's do a full investigation. Without working on what has actually happened. So the human experience is the most important. It's the crucial part of any study.
Do you think that sometimes it's easier to get, or maybe people are trying to prove it, so that's why they bring in all of this equipment, so they can leave with an EVP, they can leave with something on video. And can there be other explanations for that? You know, does there need to be a certain level of control? And can you control the environment?
Well, that's a great question. You have to look at all the normal things first. You have to have look what explanations you can have, where you start with the witness. And if you get all the details of the experience down first on paper, and you know what's gone on, and you've asked the right questions in the right order, then you can start to look at what could have taken place. You know, is the witness a good witness? Are there things which could have influenced the witness's experience psychologically, or is there something in the environment? Now, I am not an expert in measuring the environment, but I have colleagues who are. So I would defer to them to look at things like electromagnetic fields, infrasound, and all the other environmental factors that could have had an effect upon the witness. But you have to have the right people with the right equipment and the right training and the right approach to be able to determine what has gone on. Whereas today you have all this so-called ghost hunting equipment that people can buy online, and that somehow gives them the feeling that they can just take this and apply it and walk away with results without considering, and I know this from what my research is showing, is that ghost hunters today don't read. There are very few of them that actually pick up books to find out about things such as basic physics or the history of ghost hunting. So they don't know about all the other mistakes that researchers have made over the last couple of hundred years. So there's this lack of awareness of what's going on. There is also another criticism, and I aim that at academia, is that the findings aren't necessarily available to these people, or if they are available, they're not in a format which the layperson can understand. So that needs to be made accessible to ghost hunters as well. There are lots of issues with the field at the moment, and I'm just hoping that my research will, you know, open a few people's eyes as to where we need to go with it.
And you're from Wales. I had not been to Wales. I've been traveled a little through, you know, London and kind of that area in there. You see all these castles, all these incredibly old buildings. Everywhere you go, you feel like it's haunted, I swear. Do you find the same level of interest there as you do here with the ghost hunting, the paranormal investigators, the TV shows, the podcasts? But it also seems like there would be such rich paranormal history going on where you're from.
Oh, very much so. And I mean, the ghost stories from, you know, the United Kingdom and the nations that comprise of it, you know, you've got England, Scotland, Ireland and Wales. There are some shared experiences, some shared cultural things and folklore, but they also have their own unique identity as well. But people in the UK have had a long fascination with ghosts and hauntings and poltergeists and so on. And there are a lot of ghost hunting groups in the UK. I mean, I think the last count that was undertaken by colleagues of mine was that they estimated that there are about 1,200 ghost hunting groups in the UK. Pre-2000, that was less than 100. The current research has shown that in the US, there are in excess of 4,000 ghost hunting groups. But of course, the identity of ghost hunting groups changes a lot. They fracture a lot. They have disagreements. They split up. They form new groups. So it's very hard to keep a track on how many there actually are. But there has been a definite increase in the number, you know, as a result of the paranormal reality TV shows starting.
Do you think with the popularity of those shows, it's kind of changed how people investigate? I think it definitely has changed their level of expectation when investigating. I think people assume they could go into a location they've heard about, maybe they've done their own research and they think there's paranormal activity there, and they expect it because that's what happens on the TV shows.
So I think very much so. I think that it was the TV shows that lit the fire or lit the fuse, but now it's social media, which has really taken it on to, and I hate to coin the term, to the next level, which is something that Zach Bagan says they've got to take it to on each series. So you get this idea that investigations are done in a particular way, that there is a structure to it. And in the investigations I've observed, there is a formula to it. And it's very like being in the middle of an actual TV show where people behave in a particular way. You know, when I first started, the approach would be you interview the witness. If there's anything that you think that you can test, you would go to the location at the time when the witness had the experience, and you would do certain things to see whether or not you could corroborate or support what the witness experienced. And it was limited equipment back in those days. You could have your tape recorders, your camera, your temperature measuring equipment, and that was pretty much it. And you would do things that would rule out fraud. Whereas now you have all these wonderful devices that have been created, like, you know, using K2 meters, K2 trip wires, full spectrum cameras, the Kinect sensor connected to an SLS to, you know, see if you can capture these apparent spirits, you know, in a dark environment. You have all this equipment which is now brought in. You know, there's flight cases full of gear which an investigator is now expected to use, and occasionally still use some of the old-fashioned methods of calling out, occasionally using things like, you know, a Ouija board or holding a seance. But my research is showing that it's more technology-driven now than it ever has been before.
What do you think about some of the new technologies, some of those things you just mentioned? Do you find that any of them are definitely credible? Do you find that some of those new investigative tools really do nothing?
I think the problem is that it gives the impression of being scientific if you use scientific-looking equipment. And I think the problem is, and one of my colleagues, one of my very good friends, Steve Parsons, is a physicist. He's an author of a few books, and one of them I always point ghost hunters to go and read. It's called Ghostology, The Art of the Ghost Hunter. He goes through the history of ghost hunting, but as a physicist then, he goes through all the different kinds of equipment and looks at things like, you know, your K2 meter. What does it do? Well, so many ghost hunters don't know what that piece of equipment really does, how it actually works. And I'll share an example with you. I was doing an observation session about 2 years ago with a group, and the female investigator had the K2 meter on the desk in front of her, and she was asking questions of spirit, and occasionally it would light up and it would be, oh, thank you, spirit. Thank you for that. Thank you for making the light go red. So I asked her, I see you using this. What does it do? And she gave a very vague answer about how an EMF meter works. So I said, does it measure amplitude or frequency? And her face just went blank. I said, so do you know whether it's amplitude or frequency? And she was, no. I said, okay, well, have you read any physics books to understand electromagnetic fields? And her response, oh, I don't understand physics. I don't read any books. So it's like, well, if you're claiming to be an investigator and you're using equipment, surely you should know what you're doing, how to interpret it, and therefore make your results more credible. But that's a general finding of what's going on. They don't really know what the equipment does. So it doesn't help with a lot of the ghost hunting websites where you can buy equipment. They're advertising things like a full spectrum camera. There is no such thing. And, you know, I'm very fortunate that having worked in broadcasting, you know, I know camera operators who will back that up. I know physicists that will back that up. But that doesn't stop people going out and spending a fortune on this ghost hunting equipment because they think it's going to capture them the best evidence, when really they shouldn't be bothering.
What do you feel like would be good equipment to take out to an investigation?
Notebook and pen and pencil. Your mobile phone has its uses. And I always say to people that, you know, your phone is great because nowadays you can take pictures, you know, to document the environment. You can take video, again, to document the environment. It records sound, so you could use it for witness interviews. But in terms of other things, you know, just stick to what you're actually able to use and interpret properly. Most of the equipment, if you wanted to measure the environment, it should be calibrated. And the things like your K2 meter can't be. If you knock it or drop it, effectively, it's useless from that point. It will give you all sorts of erroneous readings. If you're going to want to record sound, say, for example, there's audible phenomena like footsteps heard or that kind of thing, invest the money in a really good quality audio recorder with a good quality microphone that is suitable to the job. You're picking the right microphone, because there are many and very different types of microphone. But if you went out and actually read books like Ghostology, it would tell you which ones to get. You know, invest in sensible equipment which will provide you with objective data rather than subjective things like your REM pod, which, you know, investigators think, you know, the spirits are setting it off. But have they also considered it could be somebody's walkie-talkie within 80 yards setting it off? So you need to, if you're going to make a claim, it's your responsibility to back it up with the proof. You can't just say, oh, the ghost set that off. Well, you know, prove it. We're not being antagonistic by saying prove it. You know, you have to be able to give us the data that backs up what it is you're claiming.
And it seems too, just with that approach, you would want to go back to the same location repeatedly. to see if you could recreate it, to see, you know, if the temperature, the weather was kind of similar to the day you were there. I think there would be a lot of external factors that
Most
you would
definite.
Want. It just seems like you'd want to confirm those things rather than being someplace once and going, here's what we got, yay, that you need to kind of replicate that to really prove it. And I think that's the hard thing about this whole area of study is the proving it part. I know what has happened to me in my life and I can't explain it. And I've got things that have happened. I don't know how they happen. I don't know how I was able to know some things I shouldn't have known. I don't know how I heard footsteps when no one was in the house. But I know they happen. But proving that they happen, that's the hard part.
It is indeed. And the point that you mentioned about going to a place once and then moving off to the next location, it's almost as if that a lot of the ghost hunters and the ghost hunting groups, they see it as almost like a badge of how good they are by how many places they've been. Surely it's better to visit one location as often as possible over the course of months or even years to get more and more data about that location rather than just going to 300 over a 2-year period and saying, mm-hmm. you know, oh, this is what I've got. Concentrate on one thing. You know, ghost hunters are trying to do too much. As my colleague Steve Parsons says, they take a scattergun approach with the equipment, hoping to hit something. Whereas focus on one case and just take your time with it. It's very unlikely that you're going to get to the bottom of things within the hour like Zach Bagan seems to do every episode.
And with your background in law enforcement, I would think, as someone who would look into paranormal investigations, that gives you a whole different approach to it because you would take more of the law enforcement approach. So that's why so often officers are given a few cases. They're not given all of the cases that have ever happened. Go out and get a little bit of information on everything. You can't do that. So what you want to do is focus on this one particular case or, you know, depending on your where you work. You know, there might be one big case they have a bunch of people on, but maybe you have a couple cases you're really investigating that are cold cases or something. But the approach that you would use to that, you know, talking to other people and finding out their experiences, I think there would be a lot of what you've learned from your law enforcement background that would apply to what you're doing.
Well, very much so. And it's that kind of background has also helped with the PhD research, you know, being able to sit down with people to talk about things in terms of, you know, informal interviews where you get people to trust you to build up the relationship, to get all the information, to know what questions to ask. And it also gives you a mindset about how to approach something, to gather evidence, you know, to gather sort of a chain that's auditable. And also being of a mind to say, I'm not an expert on this. So where do I get that person who is? So for example, if there is electrical interference in a building, you know, that people say, oh, I think my house is haunted, the lights keep going on and off. Well, let's get the right people in who can actually look at that and give you evidence that either supports or does not support what the witness is claiming. And being able to hand it off to other people in other areas. I hear this quite often from investigators that, oh, there's no experts in the paranormal. I would say that's just like saying there's no experts in the law or no experts in history. Well, there are. There are people who have experts, but in a particular area. And it's about having the awareness to say, that's my area of expertise, and this is not, so I will bring that person in or persons to take a look at it. And I think, unfortunately, when investigators say that there are no experts, I think it's a way of trying to position themselves as being on an equal footing. So everybody's all equal, we're all fine, we're all friends, we can't tell each other what to do. You know, but when we look at, you know, any job that we're in, you know, people have qualifications and training and expertise for a particular reason. That's why mm-hmm. they tend to be promoted, or, you know, to be able to point people and guide them in the right direction.
Do you think it would be beneficial for investigative groups? Say there's location A and it's reportedly haunted. Lots of investigators have been in and out of there. And it seems to me it would be beneficial for them to be able to share the research at that location. I know of several I've talked to that have, they keep records of what people have reported. So kind of the owners of the location are the information keepers. I would think that would be very interesting. And is that interesting to someone like you to talk to someone who's gathered a lot of information on one particular location?
That is, you know, it's crucial because it's not always possible that an investigator can keep going back to the same place consistently for months, years, or possibly even decades. Because when we think of hauntings, some have been reported in one location for, you know, several decades or hundreds of years. So to be able to have a suppository of all that information where somebody has stored it all, that is critical that we can go back and look at. Because unfortunately, I tend to find most ghost hunters, they're more focused on making a YouTube video about what they're doing rather than recording the set of data that they've got. So when it comes to somebody then picking up the baton a few months or years down the road, it's almost like starting afresh. But if you've got somebody who is being diligent enough to record, you know, all their notes, their thoughts, their findings, their data, that's great for somebody else coming behind them. There are organizations, certainly in the UK, you've got the Society for Psychical Research, you've got the Ghost Club, and you've got the Association for the Scientific Study of Anomalous Phenomena, who do keep records. And when people make reports to them, or they have investigators who are looking at particular cases, they do store all those records. And it would be great to think that, you know, everybody did the same thing and put it all into one central hub. And that's one thing, you know, we've been pushing for many years, but I think the message is, you know, it's slowly getting out, but not as quick as what we would like.
And that wraps up part one of our conversation with Dylan Jones. You can get more information about Dylan at theghosthunter.co.uk. Or you can join Dylan and his fiancée, Bridget, on a ghost tour of Savannah. Visit that website at witchinghoursavannah.com. If you'd like access to all of our episodes, including the archive and advance episodes, everything commercial free, you can become a Gravekeeper. Sign up on Apple Podcasts, where you can try it for 3 days free. Or you can also go to patreon.com/thegravetalks. I'm Carol Hughes, and for all of us here at The Grave Talks, thank you for listening.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with autopay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with autopay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. We'll be right back. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.